It was still dark and chilly when Craig parked the Volkswagen in the lot behind one of the hangars at New Sarum Air Force Base, and lugging his hold-all, ducked through the low side entrance into the cavernous interior. Peter Fungerberer was there ahead of him, talking to two Air Force non-commissioned officers, but the moment he saw Craig, he dismissed them with a casual salute and came towards Craig, smiling. He wore a camouflage battle smock and the burgundy-red beret and silver leopard's head cap badge of the 3rd Brigade. Apart from a holstered sidearm, he carried only a leather-covered swagger stick. "Good morning, Mr. Mellow. I admire punctuality." He glanced down at Craig's hold-all. "And the ability to travel lightly." He fell in beside Craig, and they went out through the tall, rolling doors onto the hard stand. There were two elderly Canberra bombers parked before the hangar, now the pride of the Zimbabwe Air Force. They had once mercilessly blasted the guerrilla camps beyond the Zambezi. Beyond them stood a sleek little silver and blue Cessna 210, and Peter Fungerberer headed towards it just as Sally Ann appeared from under the wing. She was engrossed in her walk-around checks, and Craig realised that she was to be their pilot. He had expected a helicopter and a military pilot. She was dressed in a Patagonia wind cheetah, blue jeans and soft leather mosquito boots. Her hair was covered by a silk scarf. She looked professional and competent as she made a visual check of the fuel level in the wing tanks and then jumped down to the tarmac. "Good morning, General. Would you like to take the right-hand seat?"
"Shall we put Mr. Mellow up front? I have seen it all before."
"As you wish," she nodded coolly at Craig. "Mr. Mellow," and climbed up into the cockpit. She cleared with the tower and taxied to the holding point, pulled on the handbrake, and murmured, "Too much pork for good Hebrew education causes trouble." As a conversational opener, it took some following. Craig was startled, but she ignored him, and only when her hands began to dart over the controls, setting the trim, checking masters, mags and mixture, pushing the pitch fully fine, did he understand that the phrase was her personal acronym for pre-takeoff, and the mild misgivings that he had had about female pilots began to recede. After takeoff, she turned out of the circuit on a northwesterly heading and engaged the automatic pilot, opened a large-scale map on her lap, and concentrated on the route. "Good flying technique," Craig admitted, "but not much for social intercourse." "A beautiful machine," Craig tried. "Is it your own?"
"Permanent loan from the World Wildlife Trust," she answered, still intent on the sky directly ahead.
"What does she cruise at?"
"There's an airspeed indicator directly in front of you, Mr. Mellow." She crushed him effortlessly.
It was Peter Fungerberer who leaned over the back of Craig's seat and ended the silence.
"That's the Great Dyke," he pointed out the abrupt geological formation below them. "A highly mineralized intrusion. Chrome, platinum, gold."
Beyond the dyke, the farming lands petered out swiftly, and they were over a vast area of rugged hills and sickly green forests that stretched endlessly to a milky horizon.
"We will be landing at a secondary airstrip just this side of the Pongola Hills. There is a mission station there and a small settlement, but the area is very remote. Transport will meet us there, but it's another 2 hours' drive to the camp," the general explained.
"Do you mind if we go down lower, General?" Sally Ann asked, and Peter Fungerberer chuckled.
"No need to ask the reason. Sally Ann is educating me in the importance of wild animals and their conservation."
Sally Ann eased back the throttle and went down. The heat was building up, and the light aircraft began to bounce and wobble as it met the thermals coming up from the rocky hills. The area below them was devoid of human habitation and cultivation.
"God-forsaken hills," the general growled. "No permanent water, sour grazing and fly."
However, Sally Ann picked out a herd of big beige humpbacked eland in one of the open flays beside a dry riverbed, and then 20 miles further on, a solitary bull elephant. She dropped to treetop level, pulled on the flaps, and did a series of steep, slow turns around the elephant, cutting him off from the forest and holding him in the open, so he was forced to face the circling machine with ears and trunk extended.
"He's magnificent!" she cried,
the wind from the open window buffeting them and whipping her words away.
"£100 of ivory each side."
And she was shooting side-handed through the open window, the motor drive on her Nikon whirring as it pumped film through the camera. They were so low that it seemed the bull might grab a wingtip with his reaching trunk, and Craig could clearly make out the wet exudation from the glands behind his eyes. He found himself gripping the sides of his seat. At last Sally Ann left him, levelled her wings, and climbed away. Craig slumped with relief.
"Cold feet, Mr. Mellow? Or should that be singular? Foot."
Bitch, Craig thought. That was a low hit. But she was talking to Peter Fungabera over her shoulder.
"Dead, that animal is worth $10,000 tops. Alive, he's worth 10 times that, and he'll sire 100 bulls to replace him."
"Sally Ann is convinced that there is a large-scale poaching ring at work in this country. She has shown me some remarkable photographs, and I must say I am beginning to share her concern."
"We have to find them and smash them, General," she insisted.
"Find them for me, Sally Ann, and I will smash them. You already have my word."
Listening to them talking, Craig felt again an old-fashioned emotion that he had been aware of for the very first time he had seen these two together. There was no missing the accord between them, and Fungabera was a dashingly handsome fellow. Now he darted a glance over his shoulder and found the General watching him closely and speculatively, a look he covered instantly with his smile.
"How do you feel about the issue, Mr. Mellow?" he said.
And suddenly Craig was telling him about his plans for Zambezi waters on the Chizarera. He told them about the black rhinoceros and the protected wilderness areas surrounding it, and he told them how accessible it was to Victoria Falls. And now Sally Ann was listening as intently as the General. When he finished, they were both silent for a while, and then the General said,
"Now, Mr. Mellow, you are making good sense. That is the kind of planning that this country desperately needs, and its profit potential will be understood by even the most backward and unsophisticated of my people."
"Wouldn't Craig be easier, General?"
"Thank you, Craig. And my friends call me Peter."
Half an hour later, Craig saw a galvanized iron roof flash in the sunlight dead ahead, and Sally Ann said, "Tooty Mission Station," and began letting down for a landing. She banked steeply over the church, and Craig saw tiny figures around the cluster of huts waving up at them. The strip was short and narrow and rough, and the wind was across, but Sally Ann crabbed in and kicked her straight at the moment before touchdown, then held the port wing down with a twist of the wheel. She was really very good indeed, Craig realized. There was a sand-coloured army Land Rover waiting under a huge marula tree off to one side of the strip, and three troopers saluted Peter Fungabera with a stamping of boots that raised dust and a slapping of rifle butts. Then, while Craig helped Sally Ann tie down the aircraft, they loaded the meagre baggage into the Land Rover. As the Land Rover drew level with the mission schoolhouse beside the church, Sally Ann asked, "Do you think they have a girls' room here?" And Peter tapped the driver on the shoulder with his swagger stick, and the vehicle stopped. Goggle-eyed black children crowded the veranda, and the schoolmistress came out to greet Sally Ann as she climbed the steps, and gave her a little curtsy of welcome. The teacher was about the same age as Sally Ann, with long, slim legs under her simple cotton skirt. Her dress was surgically clean and crisply ironed, and her white gym shoes were spotless. Her skin was glossy as velvet, and she had the typical moon face, shining teeth, and gazelle eyes of the Nguni maiden. But there was a grace in her carriage, an alert and intelligent expression, and a sculpturing of her features that was truly beautiful. She and Sally Ann talked for a few moments, and then she led the white girl through the door.
"I think you and I should understand each other, Craig." Peter watched the two girls disappear. "I have seen you looking at Sally Ann and me. Let me just say, I admire Sally Ann's accomplishments, her intelligence and her initiative. However, unlike many of my peers, my miscegenation has no attraction for me whatsoever. I find most European women
mannish and overbearing and white flesh insipid, if you will pardon my plain speaking.
I'm relieved to hear it, Peter, Craig smiled.
On the other hand, the little schoolteacher there strikes me as...
You are the word, master. Give me a word for her, please.
Toothsome?
Good.
Nubile?
Even better, Peter chuckled.
I really must find time to read your book.
And then he was serious again as he went on.
Her name is Sarah. She has 4 A-levels and a high school teacher's diploma. She has qualifications in nursing. She is beautiful and yet modest, respectful and dutiful with traditional good manners. Did you see how she did not look directly at us men?
That would have been forward. Peter nodded approval.
A modern woman with old-fashioned virtues. Yet her father is a witch doctor who dresses in skins, divines by throwing the bones, and does not wash from one year to the next.
Africa, he said.
My wonderful, endlessly fascinating, ever-changing, never-changing Africa.
The two young women returned from the outhouses behind the school and were chatting animatedly to each other, while Sally Ann clicked away with her camera, capturing images of the children with their teacher, who seemed not much older than they. The two men watched them from the Land Rover.
"You strike me as a man of action, Peter, and I cannot believe you lack the bride price," Craig asked. "What are you waiting for?"
"She is Matabele, and I am Mashona. Capulet and Montague," Peter explained simply, "and that is the end of it."
The children, led by Sarah, sang them a song of welcome from the veranda, and then, at Sally Ann's request, recited the alphabet and the multiplication tables while she photographed their intent expressions. When she climbed back into the Land Rover, they trilled their farewells and waved until the billowing dust hid them. The track was rough, and the Land Rover bounced over the deep ruts formed in the rainy season, in black glutinous mud, and dried now to the consistency of concrete. Through gaps in the forest, they glimpsed blue hills on the northern horizon, sheer and riven and uninviting.
"The Pongola Hills," Peter told them. "Bad country."
And then, as they neared their destination, he began telling them what they might expect when at last they arrived.
"These rehabilitation centres are not concentration camps, but are, as the name implies, centres of re-education and adaptation to the ordinary world."
He glanced at Craig.
"You, as well as any of us, know that we have lived through a dreadful civil war. 11 years of hell that have brutalized an entire generation of young people. Since their early teens, they have known no life without an automatic rifle in their hands. They have been taught nothing but destruction and learned nothing except that a man's desires can be achieved simply by killing anybody who stands in his way."
Peter Fungabera was silent for a few moments, and Craig could see that he was reliving his own part in those terrible years. Now he sighed softly.
"They, poor fellows, were misled by some of their leaders. To sustain them in the hardships and privations of the war, they were made promises that could never be kept. They were promised rich farming land and hundreds of head of prime cattle, money and motor cars, and many wives of their choice."
Peter made an angry gesture.
"They were built up to great expectations, and when these could not be met, they turned against those who made the promises. Every one of them was armed, every one a trained soldier, who had killed and would not hesitate to kill again. What were we to do?"
Peter broke off and glanced at his wristwatch.
"Time for lunch and a stretch of the legs," he suggested.